So I'd like to start by telling you a little about a woman called Elisa Zinovievna Rosenbaum. She was born in 1905 in St. Petersburg in Russia, and after her family emigrated to the United States, she gave herself the name Ayn Rand. So some of you may have heard of her as a novelist. She's not generally well known in the UK, but amongst some groups of people, she is a significant, even a revered influence. So, for example, at the end of 2013, Goldsmith Hall in the City of London was packed with several hundred bankers, economists, political advisors, and business leaders who were there to hear the annual Ayn Rand lecture organised by the Adam Smith Institute. And in the talk entitled Ayn Rand, More Relevant Now Than Ever, the audience heard a man called Lars Seer Christensen, the chief executive officer of a Danish investment bank, declare that the world is on the wrong track and conclude that Ayn Rand is the only answer. And it said that the audience responded enthusiastically. Although she died in 1982, she obviously has still considerable influence among certain groups of people in the UK. She's much more well known and popular in the United States. So in the 1990s, a survey done by the United States Library of Congress named one of Ayn Rand's books, a novel called Atlas Shrugged, as one of the most influential books in the United States, second only after the Bible. You may remember, some of you, in 2012, not long ago, the Republican vice presidential candidate in the US presidential election of that year was a man called Paul Ryan. He's a prominent member of the United States Congress, and he prepares the majority Republican Party's budget proposals. And he cites Ayn Rand as a major formative influence on his thinking. Another man called Alan Greenspan, who was from the late 1980s for 20 years the head of the United States Federal Reserve Bank, probably one of the most important economic institutions in the world, Alan Greenspan was a friend and admirer of Ayn Rand. So who was she? And how is she relevant to a talk on the gift relationship? Well, as I said, she was a Russian emigre. She lived most of her life in the United States. She had a philosophical system that she called objectivism. And she wrote several novels in the 20th century designed to promote her philosophy. And she has particular significance for this talk because she viewed altruism as a disease that is incompatible with freedom, with capitalism, and with individual rights. For her, altruism was a kind of primitive social instinct left over from our earlier evolution as humans. And she held the view that we may still be in evolution as a species and living side by side with some missing links. And these missing links could be found, she thought, in those people who fail to utilize their rational selfishness to its full potential. She deeply believed that each, this is her quote from her, each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest. And in her novel, Atlas Shrugged, the hero, who is a man called John Galt, exclaims, "I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man nor ask another man to live for mine." And Ayn Rand's conclusion was, again, quote, "If any civilization is to survive, it is the morality of altruism that men have to reject." So it's difficult to imagine a view more completely opposed to everything that Buddhism stands for. The Buddha exhorted his disciples to go forth for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, the good, and the happiness of gods and men. Altruism and giving are central to the Buddhist path, and I will return to this later. But I want to start by taking a closer look at how generosity and altruism are viewed by mainstream economists to see whether they share Ayn Rand's perspective. Some of them we know do, but whether generally in economics Ayn Rand's perspective on altruism is shared. And to do this, I want to talk about a book called The Gift Relationship, from which the title of this talk is taken. This is a book published in 1970 by a man called Richard Titmuss, who was then Professor of Social Administration at the London School of Economics. And in this book, Richard Titmuss compared the blood donation systems then existing in the United States and in the United Kingdom. Blood donation in the United Kingdom relied on people giving blood voluntarily for no financial reward. Blood was given as a gift. And donations of blood were then used for unknown strangers who received the blood at no charge. They did not pay for the blood. So the UK system existed outside the market rules of economics and relied upon altruism, upon a spirit of generosity. Blood donation in the United States relied very much upon commercial blood banks that paid donors for their blood and then sold the blood on at a price. So the system in the United States was market-based and relied upon monetary transactions. So what did Richard Titmuss find in his study? Well, when he compared the UK and the USA, the first thing that he found was that the quantity and the quality of the blood donated in the UK were higher than in the United States. In particular, the quality of the blood in the USA was poorer, because in a market for blood, those who had the greatest incentive to supply it for money were those with the unhealthiest blood, especially drug and alcohol addicts, who also had the strongest incentive to lie about their medical condition. You have to remember, in the 60s and early 70s, the system of testing blood donations was much less well developed than now. That was the first finding. But Richard Titmuss had a deeper objection to the commercialization of the blood donor system. He believed that commercialization of the blood donor system eroded the spirit of altruism and generally diminished the propensity of people to give to others. In this way, he said, the gift relationship in society was undermined, something which he very much regretted. So what Titmuss feared was the general erosion of moral values in society by the crowding out effect of market values through the process of commercialization. By eroding opportunities for people to be altruistic, the culture of giving would be diminished, and others would have fewer examples of altruistic behaviour from which to learn. So that was his deeper objection. His thesis, his conclusion, did not go unchallenged by economists. So one of his main critics was a distinguished American economist of that time called Kenneth Arrow. And in his criticisms, Kenneth Arrow relied upon two assumptions about human nature that economists tend to take for granted. The first assumption was that commercialization does not change people's propensity to be altruistic. In the case of blood, it is argued, Commercialization means that those who wish to buy and sell blood can do so, whilst those who wish to avoid the market and prefer to see blood as a gift can continue to do so and give blood for nothing. In this way, Kenneth Arrow argued, everyone gains. His argument went like this, quote, economists typically take for granted that since the creation of a market increases the individual's area of choice, it therefore leads to higher benefits. Thus, if to a voluntary blood donor system we add the possibility of selling blood, we have only expanded the individual's range of alternatives. If he derives satisfaction from giving, it is argued, he can still give, and nothing has been done to impair that right. That was Arrow's argument. So he contended that in the United States system, a person could choose to give blood as a gift or to sell their blood. So in the United States, the prospective blood donor had two options. Because in the UK, the option to sell your blood is denied, Arrow argued, the freedom of the potential donor is restricted. And since two freedoms are better than one, the system that includes the market alternative, the possibility to sell your blood at a price, is superior to the one that denies that choice. This is the freedom of the market. So that did not go unchallenged. Some of you may have heard of Peter Singer, the moral philosopher. He pointed out, actually, there are not two freedoms at stake, but three freedoms at stake. The first is the freedom to donate blood for no financial reward. The second is the freedom to sell blood. But there is a third freedom, which is the freedom to give blood as a priceless gift, whose value hinges solely on the need of the recipient because it cannot be bought. But there was a third freedom, according to him. That freedom was not available in the United States. It was available in the UK. So it turns out, Peter Singer said, that in each nation there are two freedoms and one freedom that is lost. In the UK, you have the freedom to give your blood for no financial reward, and crucially, you have the freedom to give blood as a priceless gift whose value hinges solely on the need of the recipient because it cannot be bought. In the United States, you still have the freedom to give blood as a gift for no financial reward, and you have the freedom to sell your blood. So Singer concluded, there is a choice to be made. Do you dispense with the freedom to sell your blood or with the freedom to give a priceless gift? And this is ultimately a decision about the kind of society we want to live in. But perhaps it's Arrow's second assumption that tells us more about the mindset of many modern economists and their discipline. Arrow argued this: altruism and generosity are like resources, and like other resources, their supply is limited and therefore needs to be economised. According to Arrow, markets which rely on people acting purely out of self-interest save us from having to use up a restricted supply of altruism. Accordingly, if the supply of blood depends only on people's generosity, then there will be less generosity left over for other situations. This is the economist's argument. If, on the other hand, people are paid to supply blood, then their generosity and altruism will be preserved. So, this is what Arrow says. This is a quote. Like many economists, I do not want to rely too heavily on substituting ethics for self-interest. I think it best on the whole that the requirement of ethical behaviour be confined to those circumstances where the price system breaks down. We do not wish to use up recklessly the scarce resources of altruistic motivation. He wasn't the last economist to argue this point. He argued that in 1970. Much more recently, in the United States, there's an economist called Lawrence Summers. He was a senior economic advisor to the Democratic President Bill Clinton, and he's also been a senior economic advisor to President Barack Obama. So he's not a Republican, he's on the Democratic side. In between working for Clinton and Obama, he was the president of Harvard University. And whilst he was there, he spoke on what economics can contribute to thinking about moral questions. And in that talk, this is what he said. One of the things that bothers many people of faith about market mechanisms is the idea that there is something wrong with a system where we are able to buy bread only because of the greed or profit motive of the people who make the bread. Here I would be very cautious. We all only have so much altruism in us. Economists like me think of altruism as a valuable and rare good that needs conserving. Far better to conserve it by designing a system in which people's wants will be satisfied by individuals being selfish and saving that altruism for our families, our friends, and the many social problems in this world that markets cannot solve. So it's still a dominant view in economics that altruism is like a rare resource or commodity that needs to be preserved. So we have two views lying behind economics. The first, the extreme view of Ayn Rand, who sees altruism as a disease incompatible with freedom. The second view, like those of the economists Kenneth Arrow and Lawrence Summers, who do see value in altruism and believe themselves to be preserving virtues for use where they are really needed by promoting selfishness in the operation of economic markets. Now, we may think, and I suspect that most people who are not immersed in economics would think, this way of thinking about altruism and generosity and even love as resources with limited supply, like a fossil fuel that is diminished with every use, is bizarre. And you don't need to be a Buddhist to see through this. You may a few years ago have watched a BBC series of lectures by a man called Michael Sandel, a United States political philosopher. And he's summarised those lectures in a book called What Money Can't Buy. And in that book, he says this: altruism, generosity, solidarity, and civic spirit are not like commodities that are depleted with use. They are more like muscles that develop and grow stronger with exercise. One of the defects of a market-driven society is that it lets these virtues languish. To renew our public life, we need to exercise them more strenuously. So, altruism and generosity are like muscles that strengthen with exercise. Unfortunately, as Sandel points out, free market thinking is penetrating more and more deeply into public life. And in his book, he gives us many examples of how this is happening and how market thinking works and is creeping more deeply into our lives. The example I want to talk about briefly tonight concerns immigration and refugees. And Sandel tells us about a Nobel Prize winning economist from Chicago University called Gary Becker. And he entered the debate about immigration into the United States. And he recommended, very simply, that the United States should simply set a price and sell American citizenship for $50,000 or perhaps $100,000 a go. And he argued, immigrants willing to pay a large sum of money are likely to be young, skilled, ambitious, hardworking, and even better, are unlikely to make use of welfare or unemployment benefits. Sandel's response to this is, surely anyone asking a refugee fleeing persecution to hand over $50,000 to gain sanctuary is putting forward a very callous argument. But some people, realising that that was maybe too much, have put forward another argument, market-based proposal. And this does not make the refugees themselves pay money. So it's been proposed by economists and others that an international body is founded and that assigns each country a yearly refugee quota based on the national wealth of that country. So the wealthier the country, the higher the quota of refugees is assigned to that country. However, nations can buy and sell these quotas or obligations among themselves. So for example, if Japan, let's say Japan, is allocated a quota of 20,000 refugees a year, but it doesn't want to take them, it could pay another country money to take those 20,000 refugees. According to standard free market logic, everyone benefits. The country that receives income for taking the refugees from Japan gains a new source of national income. Japan meets its refugee obligations by outsourcing them, and more refugees are rescued than would otherwise find asylum. And Sandel ironically asks, what could be better? And he tells us why this is not right. This is a quote from Sandel. There is something distasteful about a market in refugees, even if it does lead to more refugees finding asylum. But what exactly is objectionable about it? It has something to do with the fact that a market in refugees changes our view of who refugees are and how they should be treated. It encourages the participants, the buyers, the sellers, and also those whose asylum is being haggled over, to think of refugees as burdens to be unloaded or as revenue sources rather than as human beings in peril. What this example illustrates is that markets are not mere mechanisms. They embody certain norms. They presuppose and promote certain ways of valuing the goods being exchanged. Economists often assume that markets do not touch or taint the goods they regulate. But this is untrue. Markets leave their mark on social norms. And this is the nub of Richard Titmuss's original worry about a market in buying and selling blood. In The Gift Relationship, he argued that when blood is bought and sold, it's not just the blood that gets contaminated, it's people's minds and values that are contaminated. The place in our society of important qualities like generosity and community is eroded to be replaced with selfishness and greed. And human beings and human qualities become commodities, things to be traded just like other commodities. Our modern economic marketplace can corrupt our values and attitudes. But the free market doesn't just corrupt our values in that way. It corrupts our values by its naked rejoicing in greed and its naked promotion of greed. And perhaps the most famous statements in support of selfishness and greed were made in the 1980s, one by a real life figure and one by a fictional figure. The real life figure was a man called Ivan Bursky, who was a Wall Street trader, and the fictional figure was a character called Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas in the film Wall Street. So Bursky first, the real life Wall Street trader. In May 1986, he gave a very famous speech. At that time, he was a hugely successful and fabulously rich Wall Street trader. And he gave a speech at the University of California, Berkeley School of Business, in which he said, greed is all right, by the way. I want you to know that. I think greed is healthy. You can be greedy and still feel good about yourself. According to a newspaper report, the people in the audience laughed and applauded. A few months later, he went to jail because it turned out that he'd amassed some of his wealth through illegal trading. But his words lived on in the 1987 film Wall Street, in the character Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas. And there's a scene in that film where the character Gordon Gekko is trying to convince shareholders of a company that they should let him take over the company and basically sell it off. This is what Gordon Gekko says in the film. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms. Greed for life, greed for money, greed for love, greed for knowledge has marked the upward surge of mankind. And late in 2013, London Mayor and leading British Conservative politician, now Member of Parliament, maybe future leader of the Conservative Party, Boris Johnson, declared, inequality is essential to foster the spirit of envy, and he hailed greed as a valuable spur to economic activity, calling upon the Gordon Gekkos of London to display their greed to promote economic growth. So greed is very much alive and rejoiced in by not just Boris Johnson, but by lots of people involved in the business world. We can see greed at work in the remarkable growth in pay levels of the leaders of major companies and financial institutions. In the late 1970s, if you were a chief executive officer of a company in the United States, on average you earned 26 and a half times more than the pay of the average worker in your company. A lot of people thought that was far too high. There was a famous management consultant at that time called Peter Drucker, and he argued that the upper limit should be 20 to 1. He thought 26 and a half to 1 was obscene. By 2011, if you were a chief executive officer of a major company or financial institution in the United States, you earned 209 times more than the pay of your average worker. 209 times more. A massive rise in inequality. In the UK, we're not so extreme. The chief executive officer of a major company in this country only earns 130 times more than the pay of their average worker. So, basically, I think you can see that in many ways, greed is endemic in our modern economic system. So, amongst those who promote the free market, altruism, if it is not to be completely dismissed as a disease, is to be preserved for the more intimate and personal spaces of life, and greed and selfishness is to be encouraged. Now, when we look at Buddhism, of course, we offer a very different ethical system and worldview to that of the free market. We know that what Michael Sandel says is right. Generosity, kindness, and love can be cultivated and grown just like developing muscles with exercise. We know this. In the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Discourse on Loving Kindness, the Buddha urges us, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. This is why we practice the Metta Bhavana meditation, the cultivation of loving kindness, to grow and strengthen the virtues of kindness and love and diminish the power of self-centeredness and selfishness. Loving kindness is not a commodity in limited supply. It is a quality of mind that can be cultivated in meditation and that grows in strength with repeated application in everyday life. We know that the Buddha identified greed, hatred, and delusion as the root causes of the human predicament. The Metta Bhavana meditation is the antidote for hatred, and it weakens the delusion that we exist separately from others and the world around us. The antidote for greed is generosity, the practice of giving. The Buddha once said, "Those who do not praise giving are fools." Contrast that statement with Ayn Rand. In her book, the novel Atlas Shrugged, the hero founds a utopian community in which the word give is banned from the vocabulary of its members. A bit difficult to conceive of that, isn't it? Banning the word give, but that's what they did. In the teaching of the Buddha, the practice of giving is the foundation and the seed of spiritual development. In the Pali Suttas, the earliest recording teachings of the Buddha, we read time and time again that talk on giving was the first topic to be discussed by the Buddha whenever he was teaching. The practice of giving in the Pali Canon is the first of the 10 perfections, and in the later Buddhism and the Mahayana, the practice of giving is the first of the 6 perfections. And Sangharakshita, our founder, comments that it's as if the teaching is saying, you may not be morally scrupulous. You may not be able to meditate even for 5 minutes at a time. You may not dip into the scriptures from 1 year to the next. But if you aspire to lead any sort of higher life, then at the very least you will give. This is a practice that's not just concerned with the act of giving something to another, but it's more about cultivating a personal quality of generosity, an inward disposition to give, a disposition that is strengthened by outward acts of giving. And it's interesting that studies of blood donors show that although the initial decision to give blood may be influenced by a variety of factors, such as the convenience of a nearby clinic or by a particular appeal for blood, over time, the sense of an inner moral duty and the desire to help or to act on a feeling of responsibility to the community becomes more dominant. And studies suggest that learning to give in one context carries over into other contexts. So the cultivation of generosity directly debilitates greed and facilitates a flexibility of mind that helps to destroy delusion. So the individual practices of metta and generosity that we practice and teach to others and that we put into effect in our individual daily lives are a small but vital part of the effort to counter the increasing erosion of moral values by free market economics. But we can do more. As a Sangha, as a Buddhist community, we can do more to promote moral values and to counter market forces. This is where the Buddhist idea of the Dharma economy is important. A Buddhist Sangha, a Buddhist community, can be a beacon, highlighting that there is an alternative to the selfishness of market fundamentalism that increasingly permeates our society. Basic principle of a Dharma economy, of a giving economy, is to give what you can and take what you need. Now, the precise details of a Dharma economy may differ from one local Sangha to another, but its basic features are clear. If we practice a Dharma economy, then those who come to classes are encouraged to give what they can afford to help enable the spread of the Dharma. And in this way, at the same time, The teachings of the Buddha are open to anyone, regardless of individual financial circumstances. And the same principle of give what you can, take what you need, applies when it comes to the levels of financial support given to those whose job it is to work at Buddhist centres and businesses operating a Dharma economy. So the chairperson of a retreat centre or the managing director of a business is treated the same as everyone else. They are financially supported according to what they need. They are not paid more because they have a so-called higher position. And they give according to the best of their ability. And of course, dana is not just confined to monetary giving. People can freely give of their time and skills in many ways. And in this way, the practice of generosity challenges selfishness, encourages a culture of sharing, and encourages a basic ethos at the heart of the Sangha, the Buddhist community. So, earlier, I talked quite a bit about Ayn Rand, so I was giving you, if you like, a right-wing view of altruism, a critique of altruism from the right. But I'm a great believer in being honest and balanced, and I have to acknowledge that there is, amongst some left-wingers, a critique of altruism. Some on the left are opposed to altruism, or at least are opposed to charitable giving. The argument that's put forward by such left-wing people was summarised recently in an article by a man called Charles Eisenstein. Some of you may have heard of a book called Sacred Economics, written by Charles Eisenstein. And a very interesting book. And he writes a very interesting blog. And he does a very good summary of this left-wing argument. So this is not his argument. This is him summarising the left-wing argument against altruism. So the left-wing argument against altruism goes like this. Acts of charity do nothing to change the exploitative, ecocidal system of global capitalism. On the contrary, charity and philanthropy and individual acts of kindness only perpetuate the system. Here's how that's done. By ameliorating some of the worst consequences of capitalism, acts of charity make capitalism all the more palatable, and they divert altruistic energy towards relatively innocuous goals instead of toward addressing the systemic foundations of injustice. They appease the conscience and make one's own complicity in capitalism more acceptable. And they can even generate a codependent relationship with the needy, in which the charitable enterprise depends for its survival on the very conditions it ostensibly seeks to address. I'm putting that out to you because I think this raises issues that we need to be aware of and to think about. As Einstein said, we can counter it quite simply in some ways. To focus only on the big picture, on the system, is an escape from dealing with the immediate needs of the people right in front of your face. It's just an ideological cover for the failure to look after your brothers and sisters. In other words, as the right-wing view falls down, so does the left-wing view. Not all left-wingers have this view, but some do. Now, when I reflected on this, it made me realise how important it is to argue for and to work for change at both levels, at the more intimate, personal and local and community level, and at the level of the system as a whole. They're not alternatives, we have to do both. Exemplifying compassion and giving at the personal and local and communal level and working for change at the level of the system as a whole are not incompatible. As Bhante would say, we need to transform self and world. We need to transform self and world. And the bridge between self and world is ethics, the practice at all levels of the five precepts, especially in their positive form, with deeds of loving kindness, with open-handed generosity, with stillness, simplicity, and contentment, with truthful or skillful speech, and with mindfulness. Those five, simply stated, five positive ethical precepts can be applied at both local and national and international levels, and that's what we need to do. But to conclude, I want to tell you three very short stories which I think are very useful for thinking about generosity. Sometimes I think stories are much more effective than a talk. So these three short stories, two of them are Buddhist and one of them is non-Buddhist. Well, the first story comes from one of my favourite books, which is called Japanese Pilgrimage by a man called Oliver Statler. And he wrote this book some years ago. It's about a pilgrimage around the island of Shikoku in Japan. And Shikoku is the home island of the Japanese Buddhist master Kukai, who's on our refuge tree. So it's his home island, and there's a pilgrimage that goes all the way around the coast, visiting many different temples associated in one way or another with Kukai and with the past of Japanese Buddhism. And in the book, he tells you about his personal journey, and he also interweaves that personal journey with stories that he picked up, mythological stories, if you like, in different temples that tell you something of the life of Buddhism in the past. And the story that I want to tell you is about Temple 24 on the Shikoku pilgrimage, which stands at the tip of Cape Ashizuri. And Ashizuri means foot stamping, and stamping your foot when you're dancing. So how did he get this name? Well, according to legend, long ago a monk came to the temple with a young disciple to act as his servant. And the disciple put compassion and generosity above all else. And one day, another young monk arrived, seemingly out of nowhere, and joined them for their meals. And the young disciple always shared his portion with the newcomer. But eventually, his older master told him off, saying, "Once or twice is enough. You must not continue sharing your food so freely." So the next meal, the young disciple shared his food with his new friend for the last time, and then told him of his master's decision. And the young newcomer said, "Such kindness as you have shown me is unforgettable. Please come and see where I live." And they went off together, followed secretly by the older master, who had become suspicious of what was happening. So the two young monks went to the Cape, where they got into a rowboat, took up the oars, and headed south, out into the sea. And the old master cried out, "Where are you going? Where are you going?" And the young monk replied, "We are going to the realm of Kanon." Kanon is the Japanese version of Avalokiteshvara. "We are going to the realm of Avalokiteshvara." And as the older monk watched, they stood up in the boat and turned into bodhisattvas. And the old monk stamped his foot in frustration, leaving his footprints on the rocks and giving the place its name, Cape Ashizuri, the Cape of Foot Stamping. So, I'll tell that story because I really like telling it. I think it's a lovely story. The second story is told by a man called Alvar Noah, a professor of philosophy at the University of California. And this appeared just a few weeks ago. He writes a blog. And he tells how recently he arrived at a road toll in California, ready to pay the necessary cash. But his cash was refused with the words, "Those people in front of you, they paid for you." And he didn't know the people in front of him. So he was puzzled. And he writes, "Then it hit me. A stranger had paid my toll for me. And what's more, he or she had done it for no good reason. Or rather, she or he did it for no other reason than to, as the saying goes, to pay it forward. I couldn't wipe the grin off my face. Once the reality set in that I'd been the target of a random act of kindness, I could not stop smiling. I felt so happy, so grateful. I felt blessed. I felt as if I were part of a community, a secret community of kind people." It's a great little story, that. And the third story is a story told by Taitetsu Ono, who died not long ago, a Japanese-American who was a leading Pure Land Buddhist practitioner in the United States. And it's a story about three grapefruits. So in 1968, Ono and his family were visiting his homeland, Japan. And just before they left Japan, they received a gift of three grapefruits. And at the time, grapefruits were a very rare and very expensive fruit in Japan. And since they were about to return to California, where grapefruits were abundant and cheap, they decided to give the three grapefruits away. So they gave them to his wife's teacher at a flower arranging class. And a few days later, the teacher sent them a letter, and Taitetsu Ono describes the contents of the letter. She wrote that she shared the first grapefruit with her grandchildren, who were thrilled with the fragrance and taste of an exotic fruit that they had never seen before. The second grapefruit she peeled and ate together with an old friend whom she hadn't seen for over 20 years, making the reunion a very special event. And the third grapefruit she took to a hospital where her best friend was dying of a terminal illness. She hadn't eaten for more than a week, but when she saw the grapefruit, she wanted to try tasting just a little piece. When she finished the first piece, she asked for another, and then another, until she ate half the grapefruit. The family members watching all this were in tears, happy that their loved one was enjoying something to eat. The teacher thanked us profusely from the bottom of her heart for the three grapefruits. And Ono reflected that according to Hua Yen Buddhism, Hua Yen Buddhism was a Japanese Buddhist tradition based on a teaching known as the Flower Garland Sutra. According to Hua Yen Buddhism, a small act of giving has wider effects in an interdependent and interconnected world. And Ono concluded, "No one can measure the effects of a single act of giving, for its repercussions are beyond our limited imagination." Thank you.